clerk will call the docket.
Charles Tanner Severance against the Commonwealth of Virginia. James W. Hundley, the appellant. Mark R. Herring, Attorney General. Robert A. Jameson III, Senior Assistant Attorney General, the appellate.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Chief Justice, please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
I am Jim Hundley. I'm appearing here today on behalf of the appellant in this case, Charles Severance. Mr. Severance stands convicted of a number of charges stemming from three separate murders that occurred in the city of Alexandria between December of 2003 and February of 2014. However, the sole issue before the court today is whether two of these murders, which occurred within 3 years of one another, one occurred in 2013, one occurred several months later in 2014, whether those two murders are sufficient to support two separate capital sentences under Virginia Code 18.2-31, subsection 8. Mr. Severance was convicted under count one of an indictment that charged that he murdered Ruth Ann Lodato, and within a three-year period did murder Ronald Kirby. Count five of the indictment simply reversed the order of that count one and charged that Mr. Severance murdered Ronald Kirby and within a three-year period murdered Ruth Ann Lodato. The jury convicted Mr. Severance of both counts, and then prior to his sentencing, defense counsel objected on double jeopardy grounds to the court imposing sentences on both counts.
May I ask you this,
yes.
Counsel? As I understand it, the multiple punishment doctrine of double jeopardy forbids being punished twice for the same offense. So far, so good?
Yes.
What am I missing? There are two murders, different offenses.
Yes. The place to begin in answering that question, Your Honor, and
let me just stay with the simplest point. The multiple punishment doctrine,
right.
Double jeopardy, forget statutory interpretation, forget all of the other canons of construction, just conceptually, forbids being punished twice for the same offense.
The same offense.
This man committed two offenses.
He did.
Killed two different people.
Correct.
Two different occasions. Why are we talking about the multiple punishment clause or the doctrine at all?
Because Section 31A contains a numerical ingredient, and it requires the guilty of that section.
That's a different issue. Murder. That's what the statute says or doesn't say. That's a different question.
Yes.
The statute can say, statutes go far beyond multiple punishment doctrine, but double jeopardy is a constitutional requirement, and your argument, I think, is double jeopardy. So my first take is, well, do I need to know what the statute says? What difference does it make? There are two murders, two separate offenses, and thus, as a matter of almost definitional law, it cannot fall within the double jeopardy clause.
But to determine whether or not double jeopardy prohibits it, the court first needs to look to what the legislative intent was. Did the legislature intend to allow the multiple punishments that were imposed in this case?
No,
if
the legislature did not intend it, you're right, but it has nothing to do with the Constitution. It's very possible, as you argue, that the legislature did not intend this particular capital statute to apply in the multiple sequencing that you point out. It's not an unreasonable assertion. But I just don't understand why that has anything to do with the double jeopardy clause.
Well, this court has ruled that to determine whether or not the multiple punishment doctrine of the double jeopardy clause is being violated, the first place to look is whether or not what was the intent of the legislative branch.
But that's when you start off with the first premise, which is you have one offense and two punishments. And all of the cases you cite, everyone say correctly, well, they can in fact punish you twice, the legislature can, for the same offense. But you don't have to, the syllogism doesn't begin in this case for me because we're not dealing with the same offense, the constitutional syllogism. Your statutory argument is a different argument.
I would submit that this court has, in particularly in Buchanan, which is discussed at length in the Andrews case under in examining 31.7, indicated that the same provision, the exact same phrasing, more than one killing, double jeopardy would prohibit the imposition of multiple punishments where less where for each killing. Buchanan in particular is
for each killing. One killing, one offense.
No. In Buchanan, what the court ruled, Buchanan involved four killings under 31.7, four murders all within one transaction. And the court ruled that only one capital punishment could be imposed under 31.7. The court explained that at most four murders would support two capital punishments.
I'm not trying to contest your statutory analysis. I'm really only asking about the multiple punishment doctrine. I guess I'm not communicating very well. I get your statutory analysis, but that's a statutory analysis.
But my understanding of the constitutional analysis is that first you look to the legislative intent. And if the legislative intent is unclear, then you can move on to such things as the Blockberger analysis.
Right.
To determine whether or not multiple punishments violate. Our position is not, just to be clear, my position is not that you need two murders to support a conviction under 31.8 and you can't have any other punishments. Buchanan discussed that as well. Buchanan said, ended up with the Commonwealth in that case indicted four capital murder charges and four first-degree murder charges. And in the end, the court struck three of the capital murders and said only one could stand and upheld three of the first-degree murders and struck the other one.
You're familiar with the facts of Buchanan. Let me ask you a question that I'm going to ask an identical question to Mr. Anderson, and that is, can we affirm the Court of Appeals without overruling Buchanan? Or maybe for you, I should say, does Buchanan alone prevent us from affirming the Court of Appeals?
I think I have to concede the answer is no, because Buchanan is an interpretation of 31.7, which is a different statute, involves an issue of same transaction, not the three-year transactional period. So this court could come up with a different doctrine for 31.8 as opposed to 31.7, but the logic of why the court would do that, I don't think stands up. Because the phrasing is identical, and the purpose of the capital murder statute in both cases is identical. The legislature chose, as it's graded in this case, the numerical ingredient, two murders. And the reason they did that was because the capital murder statute is designed to limit the ultimate sanction to the worst offenders. And that's how they chose to do it. And so when the Court of Appeals and the trial court opined that, well, you're asking us to take two what are otherwise first degree murders and convert them to one capital murder, that's an anomalous result. That argument loses sight of the fact that we're talking about a death sentence. We're talking about the ultimate sanction for the worst offender. But it also loses sight of the argument that you don't get the anomalous result the trial court was worried about. Buchanan makes that clear. You could have a capital murder conviction and still have a first degree murder conviction in this case for the two murders.
Do you believe that 31.8 is clear? In other words, is non-ambiguous?
I believe that's true. I think the phrase more than one killing, while it's deceptively simple, indicates, as this court has ruled, that that's a numerical ingredient requiring two murders to support one conviction.
In light of that answer, is it should we give any weight to the fact that Buchanan preceded 31.8, or do we just look at 31.8 in a vacuum?
I think the history of 31-8 is interesting because it was enacted in 1996, and it constituted an expansion of the capital murder statute. And what it really did was it expanded 31-7. Before that, multiple murders were only capital murder for a same transaction offense. This opened it up to the 3-year window as well. So the logic that this court has used in Buchanan and Andrews, while perhaps not binding precedent, is certainly powerful, persuasive logic, I would submit.
Thank you.
May I follow up with you with a quote from our Coleman case, and which is also citing and quoting from the U.S. Supreme Court. In the prosecution of two crimes in the same trial, the double jeopardy defense, speaking of multiple punishments doctrine, quote, does not apply unless A, the defendant is twice punished for one criminal act, and B, the two punishments are either for the same crime or one punishment is for a crime which is lesser included offense of the other. We're not talking about one criminal act here. We're talking about two, killing Kirby in 2013, Lodato in 2014. So explain to me why I'm missing your double jeopardy argument.
Because the statute defines the one offense as requiring two murders. That's the gradient. That's the elevation that the General Assembly imposed on 31-8 to make the ultimate sanction available. So that's why, because it is defined as one offense.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Why couldn't the language in the statute be interpreted to mean that what the legislature intended was that each murder in the judgment of the legislature is more deserving of a greater punishment if they both occur?
Well, and that's the interpretation that the lower courts and the Commonwealth Attorney have given to it. They're reading that language to be the equivalent of one murder within 3 years of another murder. But this court has said in interpreting 31-7, the killing of more than one person isn't to be interpreted that way. It's not one.
Why not?
Well, I don't know that Buchanan gave a solid rationale for why it did that, but it was very clear that when it said it would take four murders to get two capital punishments, the court was clear that it was requiring the numerical ingredient, not the sort of temporal ingredient that Your Honor is suggesting.
I guess the question I have is, do you think that the language of the statute requires the court to impose that numerical ingredient you're talking about?
I would suggest that at the very least policy would require it or suggest that it should be done, because you want, for the capital murder statute to be constitutional, you want to limit it to the most serious offenses so that only the worst offenders can be subjected to the ultimate sanction of death. And so requiring two murders to support a capital punishment is what the legislature has done here.
Why does the Constitution require that? Is it still double? Is that your double jeopardy argument? The Constitution requires us to interpret the statute the way you want it interpreted?
Well, no, the double jeopardy argument is simply that you're imposing multiple punishments for the offense, given the way the legislature has defined it. My argument here is more one of policy for the court in that the purpose of the capital murder statute is to limit it.
So, under your logic, if the statute, if 8 flat out said, no, we actually intend to do what we're trying to say here, is an aggravator, and both of these offenses can be punished as capital offenses. Mm-hmm. If it's just said that in plain language, would you say the double jeopardy clause was violated?
No, because the legislative intent would be clear that so it's if we one killing with a different gradient.
Okay, so therefore, don't let me trap you here. Therefore, if we interpret it that way without the belt and suspenders language that you're wanting,
right,
how can there be a double jeopardy problem, which is pretty much what your whole brief says?
Yes. And what I'm asking the court to do is not to interpret it that way, to recognize that the General Assembly would have been aware of this court's prior holdings interpreting 31-7 and must have intended it, must have intended that.
Do 31.7 and 31.8 change the two murders that took place, murder one, murder two, into a new offense, which is capital murder, by adding the two together? So it is one offense of capital murder. Isn't that the reading of 18.231?
Your Honor, if I understand you correctly, I think my answer is yes. I'm arguing that you have to have two murders.
Well, one offense.
Which
is capital murder.
Which is capital murder. And that allows the imposition of a death sentence.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Robert Anderson. For the Commonwealth, I submit that the trial court's ruling in this case was correct and that many of the problems with the defendant's proposed construction of Section 18.2-31.8 remain unanswered as we speak. I would really urge the Court, I'm sure it's already looked at it, to look at pages 77 to 85 of the appendix, because I can't really improve upon the judge's ruling. I do think legislative intent under the precedent of this court is clearly important in trying to figure out the proper scope of the statute and how it plays out.
How can we reach legislative intent unless we find the statute isn't clear?
Well, I think the court has said in several, well, for example, let me back up. In the Willie Turner death penalty case, where there was conviction for capital murder during a robbery, and also a separate firearm, use of a firearm count, the court said that the language of the firearm count made it explicitly clear that it was a separate offense punishable irrespective of anything else. That was clear cut. That was explicit. But the court has said in other cases it's not so clear on the face of the statute how it's supposed to play out. So,
is it your position that the statute is ambiguous?
No, I don't think it's ambiguous, but I don't think it probably has the equivalent explicit provision that you have in 18.2-53.1. One thing that becomes important...
Let me ask the same question that I asked the opposing counsel. Can we affirm the Court of Appeals without overruling Buchanan?
No, sir, Justice Mims. And I think Andrews is helpful in that regard. And by the way, up and throughout the...
I'm sorry, you think we do need to overrule...
Oh, no, I think Buchanan addressed a discrete matter. I don't think this court has to overrule Buchanan at all. There's no reason to. This court recently in Andrews discussed the import of the holding in Buchanan, which was important for its own purposes, but it said, talking about Buchanan, once the evidence had established particulars of the crime, the Commonwealth could seek only to obtain one punishment under 18.2-31.7, which is the multiple.
Yeah, I mean, Andrews is really not on point since it dealt with both 31.7 and 31.8.
Well, but my point is that Andrews said that if we sustained the Commonwealth's position, it would be at odds with prior case law, which is one reason they eschewed the Commonwealth's construction. And their own, this court's own description of Buchanan was the Commonwealth, talking about Buchanan, once the evidence established particulars of the crime, the Commonwealth could seek to obtain only one punishment under 31.7, for all the deaths that were part of the same act or transaction. That's what Buchanan dealt with, the same act or transaction. The case at bar does not involve the same act or transaction. Ronald Kirby was premeditatedly killed on November 11th, 2013. Ruth Ann Lodato was premeditatedly killed February 6, 2014, about 3 months later. The Court of Appeals, by the way, in its opinion, emphasized the fact that they were separate crimes committed at separate times. So by this court's own characterization of Buchanan, it dealt with something that's not involved in this case. It dealt with the number of punishments allowable where all the deaths were part of one act or transaction. That did not happen here, so I think the court certainly does not need to overcome.
If we interpret 8 the way the CAB did and the way the trial court did, why would any prosecutor ever use 7? If they can get a capital murder for every murder that occurs within a 3-year period, why would they use 7 and only get one capital murder for every murder that occurred in the same transaction?
Well, for one thing, Justice Powell, 7 is often, by its own terms, not applicable if you don't have.
But what? if it is, if they are the facts of 7 and Buchanan, why would any prosecutor use 7 when they can use 8 and get a capital murder for all 5 of the victims in Buchanan, if that situation repeated itself?
Well, I think they probably could. But that's still, the fact is, Buchanan did not deal with.
I'm not so much dealing with the facts of Buchanan now. It's a different question from do we need to overrule Buchanan. But it seems that Buchanan dealt with several murders in one transaction.
Yes.
8 then expanded it to say they don't have to be in the same transaction, but if they occur within 3 years, it's a capital murder offense. My read of that. I understand that you disagree with that. But if that's the read of those two code sections, then 8 makes 7 no longer useful, no longer necessary.
Well, no, I think if in fact you have 2 murders at the same time and nothing before, nothing after, there'd be no particular reason not to prosecute under 7 because by its express terms, that's the situation you have.
If the prosecution had elected to charge first-degree murder for the Kirby murder and capital murder for the Lodato murder, we wouldn't be here today, correct?
I don't think so. The judge indicated the problems with that kind of, the trial judge, Judge Bellows, indicated the problems with that kind of scenario. I do think that there are certain anomalies that he identified that I think are important just in terms of the case law of this court. Because, for example, in the Fitzgerald death penalty case where there was an issue of whether the defendant was convicted of capital murder and commission of rape, capital murder and the commission of robbery, the argument was he could not be separately sentenced on the predicate crimes of rape and robbery. And the court pointed out the anomaly that someone could be prosecuted for first-degree murder and I think second-degree murder. In any event, the result was that the less culpable person would get the heavier punishment, what the General Assembly surely could not have intended. A simple example that the judge below gave is that suppose the defendant commits 2 murders within a 3-year period, and they're both charged, they're prosecuted and convicted for first-degree murder. There'd be no question that that defendant could get 2 potential life sentences for those first-degree murders. And yet here, with the commission of capital murder, a more serious crime by definition, the worst of the worst, so to speak, it's a lesser penalty. That can't be what the General Assembly intended.
Can I ask you this? In Buchanan, we held that the several murders were part of, quote, the same act or transaction, end quote. That was Buchanan.
Yes.
Was the killing of Kirby and Lodato part of the same act?
No, sir.
Was it part of the same transaction?
No, sir. So that's one reason, by the way, that the heavy reliance heretofore by the defendant, almost exclusively in the Court of Appeals, falls by the wayside because the convictions there were in the apartment were part of the same act or transaction. I'll give you another hypothetical. I think I gave this in the Court of Appeals. Suppose, just to show that this could not be the result that the General Assembly intended. Suppose you have someone along the lines of a Ted Bundy who's arrested, interrogated, and said, okay, I've committed this recent murder. Then you have follow-up questioning, and he says, not only have I done that, but in the last 3 years, I committed 9 separate, distinct, isolated murders. By the defendant's reasoning, you have actually one crime, not even 10 crimes, but you have one crime, and perhaps, and worse, you have one punishment. I submit the General Assembly could not possibly...
Isn't the defendant's analysis that you have 9 first-degree murder and 1 capital murder?
The point is, I think, Your Honor, that there's no prohibition on 10 capital murder charges because they all fell within the 3 years. So the question is, despite the commission of those 10 capital crimes, if there's still only one punishment allowable, I submit the General Assembly
punishment. I mean, there's still no one's questioning you can get up to life for a premeditated murder, which is pretty significant punishment. The question is, can you double down on capital punishment?
I think, for the reasons I've indicated, I think there's no prohibition. I think the General Assembly intended it. Let me point out something else that the trial judge said that I regard as very persuasive. It makes perfect sense in terms of trying to figure out what the General Assembly had in mind. You commit a crime, a premeditated murder in year one. Under my reading of the statute, and this is what the judge pointed out, if you have a second premeditated murder within the following 3 years, that defendant is put on notice basically at the outset that not only is the second murder going to be prosecutable as capital murder, but the first murder will be as well. In other words, the defendant has the strongest disincentive not to commit a second murder within that 3-year period. I would point out that this court in the Graham case, and I think it was reiterated in the Berlau case. Let's see if I can find this. This was talking about subsection 7, but I think the reasoning would extend here as well. Graham described the offense there as qualitatively more egregious than an isolated act of premeditated murder. Berlau repeated that. You have the first murder, that's an isolated act of premeditated murder. You have a second murder within the 3 years, that is qualitatively more egregious. And therefore, I submit that that would mean that you could have a second sentence imposed.
On the second murder.
Right.
So one punishment, one offense. So where's the double jeopardy issue in this case?
Well, I don't think there is one, partly because of the legislative intent argument I've made, but also I would point out, Justice Kelsey, it's funny, I've had this case for a while, and something just struck me yesterday, and I'm not entirely sure of the significance of it, although I don't think it hurts me legally. There's a lot of talk about the Blockberger test, but by its express terms, I don't even know how you can even apply it here.
Blockberger only comes into play if the double jeopardy clause could be violated because you're punishing a defendant twice for the same crime. And then you ask yourself under Blockberger, well, maybe they wanted to do that. And if they did, game over. But we don't get to Blockberger, in my opinion, here because we're not punishing the man twice for the murder of Kirby and twice for the murder of Lodato. We're punishing him once for Kirby and once for Lodato.
Well, I don't hear any of us asking about Blockberger.
Well, one sentence. Blockberger said when the same act or transaction constitutes a violation of 2 distinct statutory provisions, then you apply the test. We're lacking both of those here. We don't have the same act or transaction, and we don't have 2 distinct statutory provisions. So, again, even if the court were otherwise inclined to apply Blockberger, I'm not even sure how it would go about doing it, although I would just simply say, of course, that Blockberger is not the end-all, be-all. It's one vehicle, and the trial judge here found it unnecessary.
Let me ask another question, because I'm still not understanding the argument with regard to two killings, Kirby and Lodato. The statute says the following offenses shall constitute capital murder. So isn't the offense the willful, deliberate, and premeditated killing of more than one person within a three-year period? So you have to have two murders to make the offense of capital murder.
Well, that's certainly...
The offense, one offense, capital murder.
I think that's, Justice Powell certainly thinks that's true as far as it goes, but you have here two different... there are cases talking about the murder of the one person's predicate crime and for the elevation of...
To elevate it to capital murder.
You have here indictments 1 and 5 that basically...
Mirror each other.
Flip each other. And, again, I see my time's up. I would just simply say, for the reasons I've indicated, particularly the anomalous results that any rejection of our argument would bring about, is a good indication that the defendant's position should not be adopted. Thank you. I'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.